Please be seated. Welcome, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals for this in-person calendar on March 17th, 2022. We will move to our first case on the calendar this morning, which is Doran CSM SE 1 LLC versus Thomas Stone. It's case A21-1134. And counsel, it looks like you are in place. Just a few remarks before we get started. We are mask optional now, so please do whatever makes you comfortable. You do have microphone covers, and I just ask that you remove those when you're done with your arguments today. And then, as you both know, the appellant has 15 minutes to argue, respondent has 15 minutes to argue, and then appellant can have a 5-minute rebuttal. With that, I think we're ready to go. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed. Before you begin, please introduce yourself and the party you're representing.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Christopher Kahl. I represent the appellant, Doran CSM SE 1 LLC. This is an appeal after a trial in Hennepin Housing Court for a residential eviction. The appellant, my client, is the landlord. The respondents are the tenants. The tenants are still in possession of the apartment. During COVID, at a time when the evictions were controlled by Executive Order 20-79, this eviction was commenced. The events took place at the pool at the rented premises of the apartment building on May 22, 2021. The altercation involved loud music, insults, thrown drinks, punches, pushing, and ultimately the dunking in the pool. A trial was conducted in the Hennepin Housing Court on July 23, 2021. There are written closings. The final order was issued on August 27, 2021. This appeal follows. There was no review under Rule 11 of the Housing Court rules. There are three issues for this court today. One.
Before you dive into your substantive issues, counsel, I do have a question about your last comment about how judge review was passed over or skipped. Respondent is arguing that that somehow affects our standard of review. Do you have a response to that argument?
The Tonkaway case that this court is probably familiar with says the only appeal is directly from the judgment. In fact, if a landlord were to do, perhaps in the other 85 counties in the state of Minnesota, where there isn't a judge review, because those other 85 counties don't have the housing court program, only Hennepin and Ramsey County have that. If a grieved party in those other 85 counties were to do a motion for amended findings or a new trial or something like that, that does not toll the 15-day appeal time period in 504B371. In fact, a denial of that motion for amended findings isn't even appealable because the court has repeatedly said the only appeal is from the judgment. So to have a requirement in housing court in Hennepin and Ramsey that you first have to go through judge review and then go to the Court of Appeals would have a disparate treatment on those other 85 counties where you can appeal directly to the Court of Appeals. It's always been my practice to appeal to the Court of Appeals depending on the circumstances, and never has the court imparted a different standard of review, either factual or legal, upon what is being appealed. In fact, it sometimes creates some confusion, right, where we have one set of findings from what the trial court said and another somewhat different findings from what the reviewing judge said. Here we just have one order, and it is appealable directly to the Court of Appeals without
and
611.
Just to clarify, so our standard of review in reviewing the findings and conclusions of law of the housing court referee in this matter is clear error?
For factual issues, clear error. For legal issues, de novo. For example, contract interpretation, which we'll get to on the waiver issue, that is a de novo review. Whether a duty is required, perhaps in self-defense, that's a de novo review. Whether something was reasonable in the exercise of that duty, that's fact-based, so that would be clear error.
Thank you.
As I said, there are three issues today. One is whether there was a breach of lease, and for that, the standard review is fact-based, so it's clearly erroneous. The second issue is whether self-defense applies, and I believe in this situation, the standard review of that is going to be a legal issue, whether the duty even existed or whether it was met. And the third issue is waiver of the landlord regarding acceptance of payment. And because that's a contractual interpretation, as the judge reviewed it, that is going to be a de novo review as well.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you on that last point a question. It's undisputed that that your client accepted rent for June of 2021 before giving the respondents notice of the intention to pursue eviction, correct?
Yes, but there was, I think, on May 23rd, a notice to the defendants that their pool privileges were going to be restricted. So there was some adverse action to the tenants prior to the tender and receipt of the June rent.
All right. But there was no official notice that you were starting eviction. We want you to leave entirely. No notice to vacate was given before June 1st. Is that true?
I think the notice, so back then, under the Executive Order 2079, we were required statewide to give a seven-day notice prior to the filing of any eviction.
And you hadn't, my point is, I think the record's undisputed that there was that was filed, I believe, on June 11th, the seven-day notice, correct?
Yes.
All right, so help me to understand then how paragraph 25 of the lease is implicated.
How paragraph 25 of the lease does what, Your Honor?
How that's implicated, because paragraph 25, as I read it, talks about notices that are given before the rent is paid, or acceptance of rent after a notice to vacate has been given. And here we don't have that, do we?
No.
Okay.
But I don't think that is the, I don't, the problem with referee Cedillos's analysis of that paragraph is it's only kind of one direction. That is the exclusive limitation. The first sentence in paragraph 25 says, the exercise of any remedy by the landlord or management shall not be taken to exclude or waive the right to exercise any other right or remedy that landlord or management may have. Landlord or management's forbearance in the enforcement of any right or remedy under this lease shall not be found to operate as a waiver or election of remedies unless an express written waiver is signed by landlord or management.
So does that mean that the landlord could wait 2 years and then decide, well, I'm going to evict you?
So I've had that question before, and I think it really becomes kind of a pattern of practice. I think it becomes more fact-based. I mean,
why? I don't understand that.
So one of the fundamental issues behind the waiver doctrine is whether there was any repose by the party asserting the waiver. And I think if we had a situation where 2 years passed and the landlord then said, hey, that May altercation back in 2021, 2 years ago at the pool, we're going to evict you for that. The tenant would say, time out. I've renewed the lease twice with you. You've given me rent increases in those times. How can you now say it's just not reasonable, right?
Why is it unfair for the tenant in this particular case to say you've already punished me by imposing an interim or a sanction that I can't go on the pool deck as a result of this behavior? Now you've accepted my rent. Why isn't that sufficient? What's the legal basis to distinguish the situation that you have identified versus the one that I've identified?
Sure. So waiver is an affirmative defense, and there was no showing by the tenants that there was any repose, any detrimental reliance on the landlord's acceptance of the rent. Understand, we were still in the duration of the first of the lease term. That lease had not expired. Regardless of whether or not the landlord accepted the rent and want, you know, for example, had the landlord said, hold on to your rent, we're not going to take it, we don't want to get into a waiver issue, we're going to evict you for the pool incident, the tenants still owe the rent for the balance of the contract term. So there's no, they don't get out of paying the rent. Your example of if they waited 2 years and renewed the lease, that's a different situation. They've entered into a new contract.
Counsel, what about the finding of referee Cedillo that it was reasonable for the tenants in this case to conclude that the landlord had waived the breach based on the acceptance of rent? What are we to make of that finding?
I would ask, where is the evidence in the record to support that finding? There is none. It's an affirmative defense. There needs to be an affirmative showing of repose by the tenants. They did not make that.
I think that the referee pointed to the sanction that Judge Frisch had referenced in her question. and to the fact of rent acceptance alone. Are those findings clearly erroneous?
I think in light of what paragraph 25 says, the second sentence, landlord or management's forbearance in the enforcement of any right or remedy shall not operate as a waiver. I mean, we're talking a matter of days here, not a matter of years.
So let me ask you, it sounds like, just to go back to the contract, I want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. It sounds like your argument is that the general waiver provision in the contract applies over the provision relating specifically to rent. Because as I read that paragraph, there's a general provision saying, you know, landlord doesn't waive anything. And then there's a more specific provision relating to acceptance of rent. And I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. You're saying the first part of that paragraph basically precludes any waiver of any kind.
As an initial proposition, yes. And then if we get in a situation, as Judge Frisch was suggesting, a long time has passed and the tenants were to raise the repose evidence, I think that could minimize or diminish the second paragraph, right? But we're talking a matter of days, a matter of weeks, during the initial contract term where it hadn't yet expired. And I would also say the third sentence says, even if landlord or management accepts rent or other sums due. I mean, it's kind of giving an example, right? This doesn't say that the only situation will be if the landlord gives notice prior to acceptance of rent. I mean, if that were in the lease, right, and maybe some leases have that, this one doesn't, this says acceptance of rent will not operate as a waiver. And I think referee Cedillos over-prescribes the applicability of the way that sentence is read. I mean, to take referee Cedillos' position, the sentence about landlord or management's forbearance, that sentence means nothing. That sentence means nothing if this decision is affirmed.
Let me ask you this. Do we even need to get to the issue of waiver if we find or if we conclude that the district court did not clearly err by finding that the respondents did not commit a material breach or physically endanger other residents?
I would agree with you that that is a priori issue, that can be if there was no breach, then it doesn't matter if you waived the breach because you didn't waive anything. But I don't think on the breach issue that there wasn't a breach.
Well, I think there was a breach. I mean, I believe the district court, in fact, found there was a breach, just that it was not a material breach of the lease.
And I would point to paragraph 7 of the lease at the bottom of page 5 of my memo. A single violation of any part of the provisions of this addendum shall be deemed a serious violation and material noncompliance with the terms and conditions of the apartment lease contract.
And that's the violent or threatening conduct, correct?
Right.
It's not boisterous, loud, noisy, disturbing behavior. It's more serious behavior, correct?
Residents shall not engage in acts of violence or threats of violence or any other breach of the apartment lease contract that otherwise jeopardizes the health, safety, or welfare of other residents. And I would argue that the incident culminating in pushing Mr. Mahaseth into the pool and dunking him is exactly what paragraph 5 would encompass. Absolutely.
And is that determination a question of fact?
Yes. Okay. I would agree that that's a factual issue. Whether paragraph 5 and paragraph 7 apply to this scenario, right, I think is more legal. I don't think there's a dispute that it does. But I would agree that that's a factual basis. And I think the record does establish that there was acts of violence. I mean, the response by the defense is it's excused under the law of self-defense. And again, that is an affirmative defense. And the four elements are that: absence of aggression by the party seeking to assert the waiver, the defense, a reasonable belief that there was imminent harm. There was no evidence of that. I mean, these are affirmative defenses that the tenants are putting forward. They put the legal defense out there, but they don't back it up with the evidence. And that's the error in this decision.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that the criminal law self-defense standards apply in this context, that it's the same sort of affirmative defense and that we have to, you know, scrutinized based on the elements in the criminal law, affirmative action or affirmative defense?
I was thinking about that yesterday as I was reviewing respondents' brief and their citation to 60906 sub 1-3. I don't know that it doesn't. I guess that's the best answer I have for you. I mean, they're asserting self-defense, and I don't have any other authority except for, you know, the Devens case and the Glowacki defense elements. I mean, I believe it's appropriate to look at that. But ultimately, it's the fourth issue, the absence of a reasonable possibility of retreat. They could have simply walked away. They should have walked away. It's understandable what they did. It's perhaps predictable and even laudable that Mr. Stone steps in to defend his husband, Mr. Stengrud. But it's not acceptable. And that's the issue. Is it acceptable for that type of behavior to occur in a property and tell the landlord, you cannot evict people when they do this? I mean, that's the problem we have here. Affirming this decision tells landlords, you cannot evict people who take it in their own hands, and instead of walking away from an altercation, escalate the altercation. Thankfully, Mr. Mahathseth wasn't seriously injured, but the internet is—
Well, in fact, it was one of the respondents who was seriously injured, correct? Or not, well, was injured.
Yeah, I believe there was evidence indicating some photographs showing abrasions. But the internet is full of videos these days showing people landing one punch, the person falls back, hits their head, and dies. For this court to affirm that decision, the lower court would say that type of behavior is acceptable and the landlord is powerless to evict people for it. I don't think that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Kell. And next we'll hear from counsel for a respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent the respondents. The first issue I want to talk about is we discussed the standard of review here. What happens is if you go to the judge's review, you don't waive your timeline to do it because the judgment is suspended, and so the time to appeal is after the judge's. So I don't know whether in this case or not it's going to make a difference because counsel seems to be making more of a legal argument, and irrespective of what standard of review applies, the clearly erroneous standard's going to apply to factual things. But I always put it out when that doesn't happen, just to remind the court that we're playing by a little different set than perhaps the normal rules. The bigger issue from our point of view is that first, the determination of self-defense is a finding of fact. The determination of whether or not force was reasonable is a finding of fact. And so we look at the record to say, is the finding of facts as to reasonable use of force and or self-defense, is there evidence in the record which to support it? The answer to that is clearly yes, and we cite throughout it in our brief. As to the issue of retreat, actually the layout in the transcript shows that retreat wasn't possible. The area where this was happening was an enclosed area, and remember, one of my clients is entitled to come to the aid of his husband who's being assaulted. And I'm very familiar with the idea that you see people get punched with one punch and they do it. I've defended people in court who have done exactly that. But that's not the point here. The point here is in the civil context, a person who is assaulted or whose loved one is being assaulted can come to there and they can stop this. And so the record is replete with instances showing this. But importantly, we do not look at this case through the plaintiff's eyes. We don't even look at it through our eyes. We look at it through, is it the light most favorable to the eyes of the judge who had the feel of the trial and who heard the case? And that judge, having heard all the evidence, made some findings. And one of the findings was this was self-defense. And once that's there, they have a very, very heavy burden that I don't think they can meet. Given, I also find it ironic that the drunken oaf who started this doesn't get evicted, but my clients do. It's just an interesting comment that's there.
Can I just go ahead?
No, you go ahead.
Can we just go back to the self-defense issue? I'm wondering if you could answer the question that I asked Mr. Kalla. Are we required to, or was the referee required to apply the criminal law elements of the affirmative defense of self-defense? Or is the finding that this was self-defense in this context something a little different?
In my experience in civil cases where somebody's suing somebody because they got into a fracas at the bar, the courts have used the criminal law as a general rule of thumb. What it hasn't done is required necessarily you to point to everything. Again, the cases indicate that self-defense is a finding of fact to be made by the jury or the fact or the court if it's a fact finder.
So what are we to make of the fact that we have no analysis here on the part of the referee regarding any duty to retreat?
Well, one, I don't know that there has to be a finding on the duty of retreat because all of those go into a determination of whether or not there was self-defense. And let me just explain a little bit. If we're in a criminal trial and the defendant says, I was defending myself, and the jury gets instructed on the standards of self-defense, they're not required to tell the court, oh, we made a finding that he didn't have a duty of retreat. They're simply required to make a finding of self-defense. And that's all the judges, the referee here was required to do was to say, I'm looking at this, and I've heard the facts, and I'm applying the law, and the courts are presumed to apply the law correctly. And I made a determination this is here, and I don't think there has to be a specific finding of retreat, but if you read my brief, I discuss that they really didn't have a right to retreat and to do this, that they were there. And I certainly, when they're being hit and they're trying to stop violence, I don't know how you retreat from that when you're grabbed. So I believe the record shows there was no problem with the duty to retreat.
But counsel, when I look at the video or the videos of the incident, it appears that there's an altercation, then they're in the hot tub, there's somebody who charges. I mean, it's unclear who is who in this fracas, right? But then somebody charges at the scuffle that is ongoing in the hot tub and everyone falls backwards. And so I think there's some conflicting evidence, at least from the video, as to whether there was an ongoing fight, or it had been separated, or what actually happened here, which would necessitate some findings as to whether there was an actual retreat in this particular case.
Well, the only reason I disagree with that is when the evidence is conflicting, then that necessarily means that the decision of the court, the decision, the finding is supported, not unsupported.
But there's no finding here. That's my question. I mean, doesn't the district court in this particular case have to make a credibility determination as to what actually happened? And then we would defer to that credibility determination. But I don't see a finding as to the issue of retreat here.
Well, the district court determined that Respondent Stone credibly testified that Mr. Mahasath aggressively approached him, Respondent Steinrud got between them, and that Mr. Mahasath struck Mr. Steinrud order. That's
the approach, but I'm talking about the second melee that happens.
And then we have the testimony outlining Mr. Espinoza's trial testimony. I don't think the court needed to make an express finding because they're all components of the finding that there was self-defense. And if the court didn't think, if the court thought there wasn't a, sorry, I'm just peeking at my time. If the court thought that there was, they hadn't retreated, then the court could just simply say they didn't meet their requirement that they retreated, or just said, I don't find that there's self-defense. But the court found that there's self-defense here. We view that. The trial court had the feel of the trial, heard the witnesses, judged the credibility. And remember, what happened at that incident, what the plaintiffs are asserting is their interpretation of the incident. They weren't there. Remember that. And if you look through the transcript, you're going to see that the videos that were presented had been edited. And so because of that, I just think, again, we need to say the trial court is here and we should follow it.
Okay. Can I stop you for a moment? I'm looking at the crime-free housing addendum, which prohibits residents from, or states that a resident shall not engage in acts of violence or threats of violence. I don't see that provision as including any sort of exception for people who are acting violently in defense of themselves. I mean, how does this self-defense even fit in with the claimed breach of this provision of the lease?
Well, I believe that the self-defense fits in because when you're talking about an act of violence, if I'm defending myself, the law usually excuses those acts and says it's not an act of violence. If I'm attacked by a guy with a knife and I punch him in the nose and I knock him down, it's a very rare day that I would be prosecuted for assault, even though I used a, quote, act of violence. Because remember that the statutes and the criminal law talk in the same way as the crime-free addendum. It talks about an act. It doesn't say, oh, unless blah, 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 and then that comes along later. So I think that this wasn't an act of violence within the meaning of the lease.
So that, right. And that was going to be my next question. Do you think that the district court's use of the self-defense nomenclature really reflects a finding that because of the circumstances, your clients did not engage in acts of violence?
I do, and I think that dovetails very nicely with the determination that this was not, even if it was a breach of the lease, it wasn't a material breach. I do want to remind the court that in November of last year, the Fairmont housing case came out, and the determination as to whether or not a breach is or is not material, this court said we defer to the trial court in making that determination. And so given that level of review that this court said in that we defer to that, I think that, again, the court needs to defer to what the referee said in this instance. And again, this is that's probably the best example of where if the plaintiff disagreed, the appellant disagreed, that's where they should have gone to the judge and had a judicial review. And for whatever reason, they decided not to do this. I also just want to talk about the waiver issue. As I'm regularly reading cases coming out these days, whether from the district courts, we seem to have gotten a little afar from what the law used to be. So I heard counsel talk about how they needed to prove repose. No, they do not need to prove repose. The Cloverdale and some of the other cases talk about the reason why acceptance of rents is there is because when you accept the rents, you give repose. And now there's all sorts of cases that have been starting to talk about, well, what was the intent of the landlord in accepting it? I want to remind everybody that in 1907, our Supreme Court said the intent of the landlord is irrelevant in accepting rent. That Supreme Court precedent for over 100 years, and it has not been reversed by the Supreme Court, hasn't changed its mind yet. And so really, for whatever reason the landlord accepted the rent, my view is it don't matter.
So, counsel, you're referring to the Kenny case?
Yes.
So your position is just by virtue of simply accepting the rent under Kenny, the landlord waives right to evict.
Well, yes, and here's why. What the courts have said later is if you don't want to have a waiver, you can put a provision in your lease that says it doesn't constitute a waiver. The appellant did that in this instance. The appellant said, okay, I'm going to put a provision in. And the provision says if we accept rent after either a notice to vacate, or B, an eviction suit is filed, then it doesn't constitute a waiver. But they accepted rent on June 1st.
They didn't really have a choice in this case, right? Because the executive order prevented them from evicting or...
But not accepting rent isn't an eviction. You're not evicting anybody if you don't accept rent. Remember, the Exhibit 56 showed that on May 23rd, the appellant had all the information it needed to do to make a decision. That's their exhibit from their people. On June 1st, they accepted rent. They gave notice of intent to evict on June 11th. They filed the case on June 24th. So when the July rent came for it, this provision applied and said their acceptance of the July rent doesn't waive it. The fact that they owe the rent, who cares? We're not talking about whether the rent is owed. We're talking about accepting it. And what appellant really wants us to do is to change Cloverdale. And they drafted a contract that has a specific, Judge, you had mentioned that. I had it actually written as we were going this. They want the general provision to trump the specific instead of the rule being the specific provision trumps the general. And also want to remind you, they drafted the lease. So even if it's unclear, it's construed against them. So there's a clear waiver here, but we don't get to the waiver issue unless we find that there's been, one, a breach, which there may or may not have been, and two, a material breach. And the This court has ruled recently that the determination as to whether something is a material breach or is an endangerment to other tenants, that is a determination to which this court defers.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about what standard should apply here, given the moratorium and the phase out. There are a lot of different standards floating around, and then, of course, the lease itself. And it looks to me as though Referee Sotillos looked at all of those standards and sort of applied all of them in the context of this case. She found that there was not an act of violence and that there was not serious endangerment of the safety of others or residents. What standards should we be looking at in reviewing?
Well, I think that what's interesting is, given this lease and the crime addendum, there's actually quite a dovetail between that and the governor's moratorium that I don't know that the standards are all that different. And remember, in a way, it's mooted out because the governor's moratorium simply would have said, put a landlord in, frankly, the uncomfortable position of not accepting rent after a breach and waiting until the moratorium was up and then evicting them. But for what good or for ill, that's what the governor's moratorium said. And we've had plenty of cases that say the governor's moratorium and executive orders are okay. So I don't really see a difference here. I don't really see a big difference here between the language of the rule. And so I don't know that it matters which standard applies, because I think they're both so similar as to not matter. I have 21 seconds left, so if there's no more questions, my clients thank the court for its time and attention to the matter.
Thank you, Mr. Westwick.
I'll first address Mr. Westrick's comment regarding Mr. Mahathseth's subsequent involvement in the property. There's nothing in the record that indicates what happened to Mr. Mahathseth. To suggest that he wasn't evicted, that's not in the record. I think, Judge Frisch, your presentation of the video, there really were two parts of what happened. There was the initial altercation towards the drink area and the table, and then there was the pool area. And there was a time between those two. And we're not suggesting as a landlord that Mr. Stenger and Mr. Stone did anything that reasonably prompted Mr. Mahathseth to outburst the way he did. But after their initial response to that, and perhaps Mr. Stone getting in the middle of Mr. Stengrud, okay. But then to escalate that, that's where the opportunity to retreat was. And I don't think the record does demonstrate that there was any inability to retreat. Perhaps from the initial spot where the drink got thrown by Mr. Mahathseth to Mr. Stengrud and then Mr. Stone, perhaps that happened just too fast. But then, after that happened, to push him into the pool, to dunk him in the pool.
That seems to me not accelerate. I mean, this is a man who threw drinks and punched somebody. I mean, Mr. Mahathseth, that seems to me, was the one who created the, or who, if anyone, committed an act of violence. I mean, why am I viewing that? I mean, the district court seemed to agree that the tossing somebody into the pool wasn't on the same level as being punched.
But the question is throwing him into the pool justified as part of a self-defense? It's understandable. That's what somebody would want to do to somebody who just did what Mr. Mahathseth did. I mean, that's what road rage is about.
Or was it to help him cool down? He's not going to punch somebody if he's in the water, right?
And he's not going to punch anybody if they just walk away. If they would have walked away and Mr. Mahathseth pursued them, if they would have walked away and perhaps their apartment is on the other side of the pool and they walk towards the pool and Mr. Mahathseth pursues them and they throw him into the pool, but that's not what happened. They pushed him into the pool. They dunked him when he was in the pool. That is the issue where there's no justification for self-defense there. I mean, had Mr. Stengrud been in the pool, okay, and Mr. Mahathseth came into the pool as well and started harassing him, then maybe Mr. Stengrud doesn't have the ability to extricate himself from the pool safely because it might be wet, it might be slippery, he doesn't want to fall. Mr. Stone comes to his rescue, intervenes. That's not what happened. It's Mr. Stone and Mr. Stengrud who put Mr. Mahaseth in the pool and then dunk him. And that's where the landlord has the problem with their behavior here.
So it's your position that that act of putting him in the pool was an act of violence for the purpose of a material breach?
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
That is the landlord's position. Simply deflecting a drink can. No, we're not going to evict Mr. Stone or Mr. Stengrud for that. We're not even going to write a lease violation for that. But carrying the event forward into the pool is a problem. Somebody could have died. The fact that he didn't is irrelevant.
And is that an abuse of discretion by the district court in failing to make that findings or a clear error?
I think it goes to the duty to retreat. And I think if Mr. Westrick is suggesting that referee Sedillos's conclusion here, and I apologize for using the word dicta in my brief. It wasn't meant to be dicta. It was meant to be that she kind of glosses over the four elements and just says self-defense. And my position is, where are the four elements here? Where is the evidence in the record to show those four elements, especially the duty to retreat?
It looks to me and
I think that lack of record for a duty to retreat evidence is fact-based and clearly erroneous. I think there's no evidence to show that there was an inability to retreat.
Counsel, it looks to me as though she was considering the sort of ultimate question of whether there was an act of violence and referenced self-defense in that respect. I guess what I'm getting at is if the criminal law standard doesn't apply here, does your position fail just sort of automatically?
Well, I'll go back to Judge Frisch's concept that these are two incidents. If it were just if it ended at the table and it was just the drinks being thrown, I don't think there's a lease violation here. I don't think there's a breach to evict the tenants. But when they pursue, it's their assertion that self-defense intervenes and excuses what they did at the pool. I mean, I think that's their burden. I think under the criminal law, under just tort law, necessity, if you would, whatever standard or whatever doctrine of self-defense you want to apply, I don't think these tenants established in the record that they exercised their duty to retreat. I just want to say one thing about waiver. I'd remind the court to simply review the recent decision of Little Earth versus Little Ghost, where they discussed the Kenny decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. That concludes the arguments in this case. And thanks for remembering to take your microphone covers. Appreciate it.
It's a brief.